Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the death of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Republican promise to replace her has profound implications for American politics and policy. What are the potential legal impacts? How will it shape public policy, the checks and balances of the Constitution, and the 2020 election? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. On September 18th, Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away from pancreatic cancer. A longtime liberal voice on the court, her death has opened the likelihood of a court shifting to the right, perhaps quite dramatically. This is because President Trump is expected to name a very conservative judge to the court. It has also opened a bitter partisan divide in the midst of an already emotional election year. On today's show, we will examine the court's role in American politics, the likely legal outcomes of this battle, and the impact on the 2020 election. In our first segment, we examine the impact on the court's decisions themselves. Our guests are Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy and Dysfunction with Jack Balkin and Fault Lines in the Constitution with Cynthia Levinson, the latter coming out in graphic novel form, I believe, this month.
Yeah, it came out a couple of days ago.
Perfect. And Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean and Jesse H. Chopper, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. He is author of numerous books as well, including We the People, a progressive reading of the Constitution for the 21st century. Sanford Levinson, we'll start with you first. Where do you see the biggest legal impact with an addition of a new conservative judge on this court?
Legal has two questions, and two meanings in this context, and I really defer to Erwin with regard to decisions of the Supreme Court, because he's a master of this in a way that I'm not. But I think there are two ways in which this could have profound constitutional impact. First of all, I'm certain that Erwin and I agree on the importance of getting rid of life tenure. And I think we agree on substituting single, non-renewable 18-year terms. Secondly, I think it is quite likely that if the court is packed with the third Trump appointee, it will be very, very difficult for Democrats, if Democrats have control of Congress, otherwise it doesn't matter, but if Democrats have control of Congress, it will be very difficult for Democrats not to wish to expand the court, I would suggest, to 13, that is four new appointments, rather than be good sports. I think that a lot of the political universe right now is divided between people who think that Democrats really have to be good sports, whatever happens, and other people who think that Democrats should start playing constitutional hardball of a very hard variety.
Now, Erwin Chemerinsky, I know that issue of expanding the size of the court was the theme of an opinion piece that you had written in the LA Times. Could you talk a bit about that piece and what you are advising the Democrats? How should they respond to an additional conservative judge?
Let me start by saying what a pleasure it is to do this and pleasure to stand here. And I agree with everything that he just said. In the answer to your specific question, I think what the Democrats need to be clear about is that the Republicans have packed the court over what's gone on over the last 4 years. What happened in 2016 was unprecedented. Never before had a political party said they wouldn't hold hearings of a vote on a presidential nominee. And Mitch McConnell said, we should, in election year, let the people decide by who they choose as president of the United States. You can find quotes from so many prominent Republicans, Mike Lee and Lindsey Graham, saying, we shouldn't allow a lame duck president to fill a seat on the court. And of course, as soon as Justice Ginsburg died, immediately Mitch McConnell was there saying, we have to fill the seat now and we have to bring it up for a vote. I agree with Sandy that I think the right number is 13. Otherwise, there would be a six 5 conservative majority if it's just 11, as opposed to a 6-3 conservative majority if it's 9. I think it's with 13 seats that there can be a Democratic majority. And as presented as, this is the Democrats increasing the size to offset the Republicans packing the court. I know that the concern is going to be, where's the stopping point? If the Democrats increase to 11 or 13, then when the Republicans have the White House in Congress, say in 2028, maybe they'll then make it 15 or 17. And that's the risk. But the alternative for Democrats is unilateral disarmament. The alternative is a court that is going to be deeply conservative, far more conservative than the American people, for a decade or more to come.
You know, with that in mind, one of the greatest concerns about this court and in the immediacy is the potential impact this court could have on the election itself. The president has said on numerous occasions that one of the reasons why he needs to fill this seat is because the federal courts, or perhaps the Supreme Court, is going to decide this election. How problematic is that, Sandy?
Well, if we had been having this interview 20 years ago, I would have expressed some cautious optimism that I knew something about the Supreme Court and how it might behave in a situation like Bush versus Gore. But I think that political scientists and lawyers both were quite shocked by what the court did. And frankly, all bets are off. I would presume that John Roberts desperately hopes that the court does not get involved in having to decide the election. Because back at the time of Bush versus Gore, I think it was Justice Stevens who said that the court will never recover from the blemish on the notion of the impersonal rule of law. You know, I think to some extent that's true, but the court has kind of ridden that out. If the court were to throw the election to Donald Trump, I think it would be worse than Dred Scott, quite frankly, in terms of the effects on the legitimacy of the Supreme Court as an institution. And I literally cannot imagine that John Roberts wants that to happen.
There is a very disturbing pattern right now going on in the courts with a strong partisan divide. 2 weeks ago, from where we're speaking now, the Fifth Circuit overturned a district court order. The district court said everyone in Texas should have an absentee ballot. And the Fifth Circuit, with a Republican appointee writing, said, no, we're not going to expand the availability of absentee ballots, and a Democratic appointee dissenting. The next day, the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit said that Florida could require that ex-felons have to pay all their fines and fees in order to vote, which would keep 775,000 people from voting. The Supreme Court has said the right to vote is fundamental. It can't be conditioned on ability to pay. All of the Republican nominees to the 11th Circuit were in the majority. All the Democratic nominees were in dissent. Now let's talk about the Supreme Court. There have been 3 instances in which federal district courts have tried to expand the availability of absentee ballots to protect the right to vote in Wisconsin, Alabama, and in Texas. And in all 3, the Supreme Court, 5-4, didn't allow the district court orders to go into effect. The 5 Republican-appointed justices and the majority, the 4 Democratic-appointed justices dissenting. I don't mean to put this in such partisan terms, but right now what the Republicans led by Donald Trump most want is to decrease the vote. And so far, the judges seem to be following that party ideology, not the Constitution.
I agree with, or I mean, obviously the facts are exactly as he set out. You know, I think part of it, frankly, I'm not a big fan of John Roberts. I think that he is quite happy to join in voter suppression if it's relatively low visibility, so that only insiders like Irwin are aware of the cases he just mentioned. I do believe that if the eyes of the world were on him, where it really is a case, as in 2000, of choosing the president, that we just don't know what Roberts would do. And there is, of course, the added paradox or irony that Trump hates Roberts. Now, this is why it's important to get the Trumpista judge, because maybe the result would be 5-4 with Roberts joining the three remaining Democrats, should there really be the equivalent of a pooch. And that's why it is so important, I think, for the Republicans not to wait to capture control of the court. Now, quite frankly, I don't know what Amy Barrett's views are on voting and voter suppression. We do know that if she's appointed, Roe is dead. You know, maybe Irwin knows, I'm sure that Irwin knows more about Amy Barrett or the judge from Miami than I do.
Well, I agree with Sandy. I think that if either of these women get confirmed, and obviously it looks like one of them will be, Roe is going to be overruled. I felt going into this past year that there were four justices who were going to vote to overrule Roe: Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh. And the question was whether Roberts would join them in overruling Roe or just allow states to chip away at Roe. In June, he voted with the liberals to strike down a Louisiana law imposing restrictions on abortion. I think the reason for that is that the Fifth Circuit had so disobeyed the Supreme Court. Roberts was making a decision for institutional reasons, saying, you have to follow Supreme Court decisions. But I think with either Amy Coney Barrett and everything we know about her, or Barbara Lagoa and everything we know about her, there's five votes to overrule Roe. This has been central to conservative judicial ideology for decades. They now have the votes, and I don't think they're going to wait very long because they know unpredictable things happen, and they want to do it and do it while they know they've got the votes.
Although one of the great concerns there, of course, is that Roe was not a 5-4 decision. Being a 7-2 decision, the idea of overturning a case that's been law, you know, for decades, even with such a narrow decision, is there any sense of caution or alarm that the decision would be overturned 5-4, or am I being a bit too idealistic about principles of law as opposed to counting votes? Sandy, I'll ask you first.
I think you're being too idealistic.
I think these five justices want to overrule Roe. They would love it if Roberts would come with them and make it 6-3, but that's not what their focus is going to be. Theirs is going to be overruling Roe. I actually believe, though I don't think the courts do this, I think a number of those justices would like to see the Constitution interpreted to say that human personhood begins at conception and that the Constitution forbids abortion. But because conservative judicial ideology criticizing Roe for so long has been leave it to the states, I think that's what they're going to do. Don't be surprised in the next 2 or 3 years.
I think Irwin is right. I think that the great unmentionable is that the next appointment will solidify a very solid Catholic conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. It is tactless to mention that. It is an unfortunate truth that Dianne Feinstein proved herself incompetent in knowing how to raise the issue of religious beliefs and their potential interaction with the law. I think it was with Amy Barrett when she was up for confirmation then. And, you know, this is walking on eggs to suggest that religion can be relevant. But I think that to take the worst case, Trump actually wins re-election. And so the Catholic conservative majority really feels empowered. Then I think that the argument that fetuses are full-scale persons protected by the 14th Amendment will move from a fringe argument to more or less the mainstream, even if it's not necessarily a winning argument. If Trump loses, and certainly if the court is expanded, I don't see this argument going anywhere. But we just don't know what's going to happen in the next 3 or 4 years.
Erwin, what could this mean then? We've talked about voters' rights, but two specific issues, and since Sandy had raised the issue about religion, I'll start with the Obergefell case. And so LGBTQ rights, and in particular, the way in which the court had legalized gay marriage. Could we be in a scenario where the court will simply overturn that and I suppose leave it to the states, or perhaps, you know, even a different scenario?
I mean, by maybe naive, but I don't think the court's going to overrule Obergefell. Now, after all, Roberts, Thomas, and Alito vehemently dissented in Obergefell. Gorsuch, in a case in 2017, made clear he thought Obergefell was wrong, and no doubt where Amy Coney Barrett or Barbara Lagoa is going to be. And yet, I don't see why they would overrule Obergefell. Gay and lesbian marriage has just become an accepted part of our society. Here's what I do predict they're going to do. I think they're going to create a broad religious basis for discriminating against gay, lesbian, and transgender individuals. I think they're going to say, if the baker, the florist, the stationery store, the videographer doesn't want to serve a same-sex wedding based on religious beliefs, they don't have to. There was a major Supreme Court decision in June protecting gays and lesbians and transgender individuals from employment discrimination in the workplace. But Justice Gorsuch's majority opinion left open the possibility of employers who have a religious objection to gay, lesbian, and transgender employees being able to discriminate. I see the conservatives creating an enormous ability of people to discriminate based on religious beliefs against gay, lesbian, and transgender individuals, but not seeing the need to overrule Obergefell.
There must be something that Erwin and I disagree about, but it hasn't emerged yet. The only thing I would say is that a goodly number of the cases that Erwin is describing are likely to be statutory rather than constitutional because they will rest on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed in 1993. And let me say that in 1993, which now seems like a lifetime ago, I supported RFRA, as the ACLU did and many, many liberals did. Justice Scalia's opinion in the Oregon peyote case seemed very, very harsh and seemed basically to eviscerate the notion of free exercise. But that was then and now is now. And I think that RFRA has become weaponized by the religious right. It has nothing to do with the rights of Native Americans and the like. It has everything to do, particularly with evangelical Christians and some Catholics. And, you know, but I think Erwin is otherwise completely right.
And I agree with Sandy with one exception. So we have one small area of disagreement. I too supported RFRA at the time. I thought that Justice Scalia's opinion had eviscerated the free exercise clause. Things have changed so much in 30 years for just the reason Sandy says. But I predict that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is going to become irrelevant very quickly because I think the Supreme Court's going to overturn Employment Division versus Smith. Just to be clear, Employment Division versus Smith in 1990 said there's no basis for giving religion an exception from a general law under the Constitution. So it's a case that involved Oregon prohibiting consumption of peyote. And Justice Scalia said, we don't give an exception to Native Americans based on free exercise of religion. Now I think in a case that's pending before the Supreme Court this fall, the five most conservative justices are going to overrule Employment Division versus Smith and then use free exercise of religion to protect the ability of religions to discriminate, to deny contraceptives and like, which ultimately will make RFRA unnecessary.
We're back in agreement on what very well could happen.
The other issue that keeps coming up in conversations, I'll ask this of Erwin first, is the Affordable Care Act. There's obviously a case before the court where the court could overturn the Affordable Care Act. Is this more likely? And you know, how might this play out?
I'm going to start with my rational, optimistic self. I think the challenge the Affordable Care Act before the Supreme Court this fall is frivolous. The case is California versus Texas. In 2012, the Supreme Court had before it the question of whether the individual mandate is constitutional. The individual mandate is the requirement that people either had to purchase insurance or pay a tax penalty. And the court 5-4 upheld that as constitutional. In December 2017, as part of the tax reform bill, Congress eliminated the penalty for not purchasing health insurance. Well, Texas and other states said the individual mandate was the linchpin to the Affordable Care Act, and the Congress effectively repealed the individual mandate by taking away the penalty. In a Fifth Circuit case, that therefore makes the whole Affordable Care Act unconstitutional. But therefore doesn't follow in that sentence. If a court declares unconstitutional a particular part of a statute, the question is, would Congress have adopted the rest of the statute without the part? But here, there's no doubt that Congress would have adopted the rest of the statute without this part, because it's Congress that repealed the part, unless the rest of the statute stand. In fact, in December 2017, there was a vote in Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and it failed. So from a constitutional law perspective, the argument that's being advanced here seems exceedingly weak. Besides that, we're in the midst of the worst public health crisis in over a century. Does the Supreme Court really want to strike down a law that's providing 25 million people health insurance at this time? Now my more pessimistic self. Everything about the Affordable Care Act has been political since the beginning. Every Democrat in Congress voted for it. Every Republican voted against it. Before it went to the Supreme Court in 2012, with just a couple of exceptions, every Democratic judge voted to uphold it. Every Republican judge voted against it. Given how conservative, there's going to be 5 justices on the court, will they be able to get beyond that partisanship and focus on the constitutional argument in the human real-world effect if they strike down the Affordable Care Act?
Peter Finley Dunn very famously said the Supreme Court follows the election returns. If Joe Biden wins, which I think he will, it will be in substantial part because of health care. And I really have a hard time imagining that John Roberts wouldn't twist arms for the Supreme Court not to adopt what I agree with Irwin is a frivolous argument. If, on the other hand, Donald Trump wins, and we have to take account of that possibility. This is not 2016 when we were all confident that Hillary had a 90% chance of winning. Then why not strike it down? The American people would have spoken and said, we don't care about health care. We know what the Trump administration is doing, and it's fine with us. But otherwise, I think Irwin is absolutely right. And even if Trump does win, it seems to me that to invalidate Obamacare would be a poison chalice, not simply for the Supreme Court, but for the Republican Party, because they have no idea what they want to do on health policy. Just as, frankly, if Roe was overruled, I think the Republican Party will be quite rueful about this gift, because they've been running against Roe versus Wade now for literally 40 years. I think 1980 was the first time it was in the Republican platform. And Roe has been very, very good to the Republican Party, in part because they haven't been required to decide whether or not to criminalize all abortions, because after all, the fetus is a person who ought to be protected by federal law. Now, or I say now, if Roe was overturned, they're going to have to decide that. It's not going to be a pretty picture. Similarly with regard to health policy. So John Roberts is a good Republican doesn't want to overrule Roe. He wants to strangle it in the crib. And I don't think that John Roberts is a good Republican, wants to get rid of Obamacare. But his vote won't matter if, you know, the Trump appointment gets through. Then what you have to do is to make bets on the five conservatives who may be far more ideological in that sense than John Roberts is.
Erwin, last question here then. I'm reminded of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's original opposition to Roe, at least on the principle that because there had been so much movement towards abortion rights, that the court made it a legal question rather than a political question, and that it would have been on a firmer footing if the decision had been done legislatively rather than judicially.
Ginsburg's primary argument was that the court should have focused more on equal protection than due process. But for those who believe that if the court had not got involved in Roe, abortion was to become legal in the United States, Reva Siegel and Linda Greenhouse in their scholarship show quite the contrary. In 1973, only four states had legalized abortion. That there was no indication of a substantial movement towards legalized abortion then. The progress was by states adopting the so-called model penal code that allowed abortion in cases of rape and incest and when the woman's health was at stake. And also, I think that Reva Siegel and Greenhouse show, it's not that Roe created the backlash against abortion. There really wasn't any backlash until 1980 when the Republicans tried to enlist the moral majority in evangelicals to come into the Republican Party. So if not for Roe, so many millions of women would either have unwanted children or unsafe back alley abortions.
I think it's a wonderful place to end this conversation. We've discussed the legal implications, political implications of a new conservative judge replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court. Our guests have been Sanford Levinson, the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood Jr. Centennial Chair in Law at the University of Texas. He's the author of numerous books, including Democracy in Dysfunction with Jack Balkin and Fault Lines in the Constitution with Cynthia Levinson, which has just come out in graphic novel form. And Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean and Jesse H. Choper, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of numerous books, including We the People, a progressive reading of the Constitution for the 21st century, and a recent opinion piece in the LA Times that I recommend that you look up. Thank you very much.